Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we're here as usual at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. So it's the season we start to see Brussels sprouts and chicories, fall chicories, and we start cooking with sort of more rough vegetables. And what better book to explore that a bit is than a book I'm holding right now. It's called Bitter, A Taste of the World's Most Dangerous Flavor with Recipes, and it's written by Jennifer McLagan, and she's on the phone right now from Paris. How are you?
Hi there.
I said that sort of like half French. I was like, Paris. Anyway, I wanted to say Paris, but it didn't come out that way.
I know, Paris sounds so much better, you know, and here's like, it's just the perfect time now to be going out and having like a little bitter cocktail before dinner.
Well, I'm having just in ode to you right now, I'm having a coffee without milk, trying to drink it black. No, I like bitterness, and I really like your book. This is such a fun book. It is your fourth book, and you've written about bones. You've written about fat.
Yes.
It was the subtitle was like the undersung flavor of fat with recipes. And then you've also written about offal. So now we have bitterness, a complete exploration of this this plant. And why did you choose bitterness? Do you see a new appreciation for it in the world?
Yeah, well, I guess you can see from my other books, I'm kind of a little contrarian. I like to pick kind of unloved topics and give them some love and rehabilitation. And I think bitterness was just ready to be talked about and written about because, as you know, finally we've realized that cocktails aren't like appletinis and crantinis that actually have bitterness in drinks, and that's become really popular, and there's this huge rise in artisanal bitters. And so I'm thinking that now people are ready to go from the bar into the kitchen, right? They're tasting these drinks, and they're seeing how wonderful they are, and now they're ready to cook with some bitter flavors as well.
Well, funny you should mention bitters and cocktails, because I've wrangled on another guest today, and he is the co-founder of Bitterman Spirits. It's Meyer Sabareo. How are you?
Hey, doing well. How are you doing?
Good. Meyer is a cocktail expert, vermouth formulator extraordinaire. And, you know, I got to say, with, like, the new wave of cocktail appreciation, not only is it about, like, kind of the more old-fashioned, literally, old-fashioned cocktails and the spirits being used, not just vodka, it comes down to that flavor of bitterness that we see more and more.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, what Jennifer's book has, you know, pretty clearly illustrated as well is how much bitterness is a stimulant. You know, I constantly tell people, I mean, again, having run a bar that was entirely specialized in brown bitter stirred cocktails, but also having made all sorts of different kinds of bitters and spirits, you know, the primary focus has always been on the fact that, you know, because we're so sensitive to bitterness, bitterness is a great way of elevating our palates. It's a great way of stimulating them. It's a great way of making us think more about our drinks and about our food. It's, you know, it's sort of almost the opposite of the way you look at drinks that are boozy or drinks that are sour, where you're not trying to overpower the palate. You're trying to wake it up. You're trying to get people to think.
And Jennifer, you explore that in a lot of your recipes in this book, too. You mentioned that it's a great way to open the palate for a multi-course meal through appetizers, like a bitter green salad, something as simple as that.
Yeah, because it is kind of an appetite stimulant. You know, we have receptors for bitterness all through our system, and important ones are in our intestines and in our stomach, and it really gets our appetite going. And the other good thing about bitterness is that it keeps your appetite going. So if you have a very rich meal, something bitter at the end of it will actually help you digest your meal as well. Mm. You know, the thing about bitterness is it's satisfying in a sense too, especially in the cocktail world, because it actually quenches your thirst, I think, much more than something sweet does.
Ooh, so I can have that after my yoga class, a nice little cocktail.
Well, a Negroni after
your
yoga.
The thing I've discovered is from making my own tonic water, how much better that gin and tonic tastes in the summertime than it does with something sugary and sweet out of a can.
Oh, I guess so. You know, Meyer was just telling me about how they're making tonic water nowadays at Bitterman's. Very exciting development.
Absolutely.
So tonic water is meant to quench. That's the whole point. The quinine? It?
Well, not? Yes, I think the quinine, well, I mean, it was a way of disguising the quinine. It was a way to take in the quinine, but it is extremely thirst-quenching. It's even delicious without the gin.
I love how you write that bitterness is sort of a double-edged sword. It can indicate toxins, but it can also indicate beneficial things. So it's, you know, one or the other. Hopefully you'll get the right one.
Yes, but also you have to remember with something that's toxic, it's the amount that you take. So, you know, with some things that are toxic, you can take very small amounts of them. They're not going to kill you, but they're actually going to stimulate your nervous system, and they're going to alter how you feel. So that cup of coffee that you're drinking now, the caffeine in that is like stimulating your brain, so it's actually you're getting a benefit from the toxic part of it as well, right?
Yeah, you know, it's too much caffeine is, as we all know, not good.
No, exactly. You can have too much of it. It's the amount that you take. So anything like that, it's just kind of interesting how it works, bitterness. And that's what kind of makes it, I think, a really an adult taste or an adult flavor. You know, you have to learn to like that bitterness. And then after a while, you forget some things are bitter altogether because you really like how they make you feel.
And in addition to like an espresso at the end of the meal, we were talking a little bit about digestives, and that's a traditional end of the meal drink.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and everybody has their own. You know, Germans have their own. People, you know, look at Jägermeister as a you know, it's kind of a frat boy thing now, but it's actually a very classic, hallowed part of a family of liqueurs called Kräuterliqueurs, which are basically, you know, the German after dinner bitter, you know, likewise with the Italian Amari and with the French Gentians, and all of those things are really meant as, you know, great ways to finish a meal and, you know, and digest properly.
It's so funny because it's such an intense flavor when you drink these digestives in tiny cups. It also, to me, it seems like a great way to, it's like a palate cleanser. I don't know about cleanser. That's not the right word I'm going for, but it makes my palate kind of relieved after all the richness that I just ate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think, you know, I didn't realize this before. I was really surprised with myself having written a book on animal fat. But, you know, fat and bitterness are perfect partners. Mm. Or they balance each other really well. Bitterness
yes.
like balances the richness of the fat. It helps you digest it. And you put fat, which, I mean, we all do with like dandelion green salad, or we put that hot bacon dressing on there, and that's a way you tame the bitterness and make it more palatable. So they are kind of perfect partners. So at the end of a meal, any kind of meal, you have something like a digestive, and it doesn't really cleanse your palate. It just eases everything. It, you know, just makes you feel not so full, and it helps you to digestive system keep on working. And it's like a perfect. And every culture has some kind of digestive drink.
Mm. Now you do say in your subtitle that it is the world's most dangerous flavor.
Well, that's, you know, it is, because it can, you know, bitterness can kill you. This bitterness does signal toxins. So it's like through time we've actually learned which bitter things we can eat and which ones we can't, you know, which ones we need to cook before we eat them. It's kind of something that's been passed down through the generation.
And, you know, I'm thinking more and more about just the general American dining habits. I feel like bitterness has been really left to the wayside. And I imagine that's why you wrote this book, exploring it. But what are we losing in return, in exchange? Like, what are the effects of not enough bitterness, I guess?
Well, I think the thing is, you know, people probably think I have a book full of things, recipes that are going to taste extremely bitter. Mm-hmm. And not many of them actually do, except perhaps bitter melon and something like that. But what bitterness does, it's like an important part of the flavor spectrum. You know, when you add salt to something, it highlights the flavor, or a squeeze of lemon. It doesn't make those things taste salty or acidic. It just completes the flavor spectrum. And I think that if you leave bitterness out, you're losing something in your flavor. It adds a complexity and depth. You know, I think my best favorite example is to talk about caramel. Now, people say caramel, that's sweet, right? But yes, but the best caramel has a little bit of bitterness. You know, when you cook that sugar just when it's smoking, before it burns, and then you make your caramel sauce, that caramel is not nearly as sweet, and it's got much more depth and interest to eat. So that's what bitterness does. It adds complexity and interest and a depth of flavor.
It is interesting, and I loved how you did a lot of research on the flavor of bitter and how we have just categorized flavors throughout the years. And you wrote that, I think it was not Plato, but one of the...
Linnaeus, my favorite guy, because he classified cinchona. In the 18th century, there was 11 basic flavors. You know, it's interesting, basic taste. You know, I think it's kind of interesting how we narrow ourselves down to just a few, and I think that's wrong. I think, you know, now we narrowed it right down to four, you know, sweet, salty, bitter, and sweet, and then we added umami, even though the Japanese had been talking about it for a century before we agreed with them, and then, you know, the French and the Australians have added fat, which, of course, is a flavor, and maybe we should think about adding soapy and pungent and, you know, like, why do we narrow it down so much? I think we need to expand how we think about flavor and taste.
It seems like we've simplified.
Yeah, I think there's always a, you know, there's always a tendency, people like things to be simple, it just makes it easy, but really, flavor is really complex, right? And what was interesting about doing the book is that you and I and everybody lives in their own little flavor world.
I can't believe this, but it was Plato and Aristotle that you wrote about that in your book, who identified six and then eight food taste. And then Aristotle somebody, one of them thought that basically, at one end of the spectrum, you have sweet, and at the other, you have bitter, and then all the other tastes are somewhere in between, which I thought was very strange.
Yeah, exactly.
We have so many different understandings about taste throughout the years. But certainly in cocktails, I see bitterness as a really key player. I, for one, cannot stand really sweet cocktails. Sweetness has really taken a huge spotlight, it seems, in cocktails, whereas traditionally, or, you know, medicinally, bitterness was the only flavor.
Right. Well, I mean, it's, you know, if you the original cocktail is booze, bitters, and sugar. Relatively heavy emphasis on the bitters and relatively low emphasis on the sugar. You know, and again, you know, what I always point out to people, you know, which is also what Jennifer was just saying, is that you know, you're not adding bitters to a drink to make it bitter. You're adding bitters to a drink to amplify the other flavors. And so what you end up with a prevalence of sweetness in cocktails is actually a muting of all the other flavors. It's one of the reasons why you can actually, you know, see, you know, why, especially, you know, starting in the 60s and 70s, you saw all these drinks with vodka, because at that point it kind of didn't even matter what your base spirit tasted like. You were basically just using it as a delivery device for the alcohol. And, you know, and so you see the prevalence of all these drinks that just don't have bitters, and bitters literally just vanished off the shelf after Prohibition. And, you know, whereas, yeah, I mean, if you look at more evolved cocktails and you look at what bartenders are reaching for, even very accessible cocktails, you know, will use a lot of different kinds of amari and bitters and bitter flavors, because, you know, those cocktails are accessible, but they're also delicious. And, you know, a lot of the deliciousness is lent by the complexity that bitters bring.
And, you know, just briefly, let's talk about beer a second. You know, we have two shows on Heritage Radio about beer, but there's a huge renaissance of beer, just like cocktails nowadays, and it's all about the bitterness. Hopheads, you might call them, and, you know, where bitterness is king, and then that's a huge player. People crave it. So, and you know, it's not just Bud Light anymore. No. So I love how you wrote about that too, Jennifer.
That's what's interesting, because usually, I mean, before you always think of American beers as not being bitter at all, unlike mm-hmm. English and German beers, and now it seems that hops are becoming the big new crop in the States, you know, and people are growing different kinds of hops with different flavor profiles. And what's interesting with hops, you know, they added bitterness to beer, but they also helped to preserve it, right? Hops are such an interesting plant, and what I found was absolutely fascinating.
Too.
In Belgium, they actually eat the shoots mm-hmm. of the hop plant, right? Like a white asparagus, and it's like extremely expensive
nice.
Vegetable that's specially cultivated.
For any beer nerds out there, Jennifer has a recipe for beer jelly, beer soup. mussels in beer, which is always good, and bratwurst in beer. So it's Oktoberfest. Enjoy. So we're just going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more about bitter.
You're listening to Touching the Surface by Dreams.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live to the cosmos from the backyard at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
All right, we're back chatting with author Jennifer McLagan of Bitter, the world's most dangerous flavor with recipes, and Meyer Subaraya, co-founder of Bitter Men's Spirits. you know, we were talking about drinks, and I love this book because there's so many historical anecdotes and tidbits and long extended essays throughout. And I came across this, for example, on the bitterest plant in the world. And okay, so I, you know, going through this book, I'm like, yes, I know cardoons, I know turnips. Okay, cool, I know, I like that. And then I come across gentian, which is a root, I understand, that makes a bitter called soup. Who wants
it? It makes a lot of bitters, almost okay. every bitter.
Oh, yes.
I'm sure Maya will agree, every bitter has Jensen in it. It's like the most bitterest plant. You know, you can have a single gram in like 15,000 gallons of water, and that water will still be bitter.
Huh.
Absolutely. And I mean, the other thing about Jensen, which Jennifer does mention, is, you know, it's an interesting plant because it bitters things on its own. So if you have, you know, Angostura or Campari or any number of other liqueurs, pretty much all of our liqueurs use Jensen as a base. It adds a bitter qua bitter backbone. But then at the same time, Jensen itself has its own flavor. It's got a really kind of, and it's a very unique kind of earthy, rooty,
musty?
And musty, but also on the other side, kind of floral flavor. And, you know, I think gentian and wormwood are both very interesting because they're both traditionally used in a lot of bitters. And speaking of danger earlier, you know, wormwood is fascinating because, of course, you know, wormwood has a really bad reputation. Wormwood is pretty much the principal botanical agent in absinthe. And for ages, absinthe was deemed dangerous because there's a chemical called thujone in wormwood, which is actually in high concentrations very, very bad for you. It's very bad for your liver. And we actually made something, which I highly encourage everybody to try, which is a wormwood aquavit, which is very, very high in wormwood. But we had to do it about 10 times for 10 different recipes of the Bosca Schnapps, which is what it's called, because we kept on hitting that limit of toxicity. So it's delicious. It's super bitter. But, you know, we definitely had to kind of skate the edge with it.
Oh, wow. And not only can you make you know, spirits, cocktails, and different bitters, but Jennifer, you cooked with these, so you have you know, a Sue's sorbet.
Yeah. And I have some Jensen right here from the Auvergne in my cupboard. The Sue's sorbet is wonderful, and these things, like, you can add a little bit of these bitters. I mean, I used Frenette Bronca when I sauteed chicken livers, one because I had a bottle of Frenette Bronca and I wasn't really drinking it.
Mm-hmm.
But you add a little few drops of these alcohols to something that's sweet, like chicken livers with caramelized onions, and it just makes that flavor fabulous, right?
I can see
that. It's just interesting. And wormwood is a really interesting drink. You know, it got so much bad press, and it got banned. But usually most of the problem people had with it, it had a very, absinthe had a very high alcohol content. So it wasn't really the wormwood in there.
That's what I tell
people. People were just drinking way too much alcohol.
Yes.
Yeah, when you're drinking 150 proof alcohol,
you're going to be ill.
It's not going to make you feel
good.
It's
not the wormwood's fault.
Yeah.
I thought it was also interesting that we measure bitterness. How bitter is it? You write about gentian. A single gram dissolved in 15,000 gallons of water will turn the water bitter. So that's insane.
And that's pretty bitter. But it is, you know, like Maya says, it's very interesting to drink. When they make Sue's and Jensen, you can buy these alcohols, and they're really quite interesting to drink.
Meyer was telling me anecdotally over on our way that you can smell it, too, yards away. This gentian.
Yeah, one of our liqueurs is the Amer Sauvage is based on a gentian eau de vie, and the producer of that gentian eau de vie is a friend of mine who lives in the Jura, and he just brought a bottle and opened it at one end of the bar that I was sitting at, and people at the other end of the bar could smell it. It smells like an alpine meadow, basically.
That smells pretty good to me, sounds pretty good. It's a fascinating ingredient. And, you know, filled with all these nuances, too. And one thing I loved reading this book is that there's no one flavor of bitter. It's like this umbrella term under which many other categories of bitterness live. We just have a archaic way of describing the flavor.
I think it's really interesting. I think that's what makes bitter the most interesting of what we like to call the basic taste. Because, you know, we would all sit down at a table and we probably all agree that was salty or sweet or sour, or even maybe we might agree on umami, but bitter we'll probably disagree on for sure, right? Because bitterness ranges from something like a celery leaf, which is mildly bitter, right through to bitter melon or Jensen, which is extremely bitter. So it's a huge range. You know, there's lots of different chemical combinations that signal bitter to the brain, whereas with, you know, sugar and acids are the only thing that signals sour. So mm-hmm. it's a much more comprehensive, interesting, and intriguing taste to work with.
You mentioned bitter melon, also known as kugua in Chinese. And I have an interesting story because in Taiwan, where I've been many times, people drink it like as fresh fruit stands. You'll drink kugua juice straight. I think much in the same way we would drink a wheatgrass shot, whereas we know it's really good for you. It'll cleanse your gut. You know, it has so many great beneficial characters to it, but it is so strikingly bitter. I tried to prepare it for a number of friends as part of a dinner. People hated it. But it is really good for you. So, yeah.
No, it's interesting because someone was telling me that in the Philippines they put a few drops of bitter melon juice on babies' tongues. And as I explained, babies and small children have more taste buds than adults, so it must be, like, extremely bitter for them. But it's hugely beneficial. You know, like, there's a whole lot of studies being done for, like, reducing cancer cells, yeah. reducing sugar levels for diabetes. And so bitter melon is one of those kind of wonder vegetables, but it is very bitter.
At first, when you said that about the baby's tongue, I thought they were trying to get the babies, like, early acclimated to the flavor or something. But that is really fascinating. And speaking of, I thought the coolest discovery you made is something that you're still continuing to learn about. In the epilogue for your book, you write that you discovered a whole world of animal-based bitter flavors, whereas this book is based on vegetable-based bitter flavors.
Yeah, it was interesting because I guess I wanted to tell people I don't just eat bones, fat, and odd bits. You know, I do eat occasional vegetables. So, I never really thought, you don't think of bitterness so much in the animal world. And again, in the Philippines, I have a friend, and he said, in his fridge, his partner had put this, like, green bag in the freezer and said, oh, that's just pesto sauce. So he took it out and mixed it with something, and it was actually cow bile. Now, I didn't even know you could get cow bile, and it's extremely bitter.
How do you capture the
anything like that, which they mix it in with a stew with innards and tripes and all different bits, which sounds fabulous. So here I am, like, thinking, I've done a whole book and I've left out cow bile.
And this is for real. I mean...
Perhaps not the easiest ingredient to pick up at your local supermarket, but still, you know, it's fascinating, right?
It is really fascinating. I'm curious, what other animal-based bitter flavors have you come across?
Then my editor told me about a marinated cod's roe that the Japanese eat that's kind of bitter. Because usually bitterness with animal products isn't a good thing, right?
Yeah,
usually it signals something that's gone off. I'm sure there's other things I'm yet to find out. That's what I love about working in the food world, right? You learn something new every day.
That is really fascinating about the cow bile. I think whale vomit is it's
oh,
a perfume.
Where do you pick that up?
No, it's a perfume. just I don't know. If you want to write it, if you want to, Jennifer, if you want to write a book about animal vomit, this could be really interesting. I'm sorry.
I have enough problem with the books I write now, thanks.
No, okay, so I was going to say that, early in the beginning and didn't get to it, but this book is so unique. I love how you come across recipes, you come across ingredient profiles, and you have a history. It seems part cookbook, part personal narrative, part expose. What do you call this genre that you're writing?
I hope you call it interesting because, mm-hmm. you know, I think sometimes cookbooks are just recipes and mm-hmm. I think you need to give some people something else. You know, I mean, I just start and I find things that are interesting to me, from like Picasso doing a painting of Suze or a collage of Suze to, you know, it just is interesting to me. So I put it down in the book and I hope it's interesting to someone else as well. And then they're recipes, you know.
Well, I think it's a great, I don't know what to call this genre. I want to call it a food exploration, expose, but I just love that single single kind of niche focus.
Well, you know, I think it's important. You know, food is culture, so mm-hmm. food can encompass. You know, in my odd bits, I had poetry. You can have poetry, you can have art, you can have literature, you can have everything in a cookbook because food is part of our culture.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for this cookbook, and thank you also, Meyer, for joining in on the cocktail expertise. And that's about all the time we have for today's episode. Thanks for calling in, and thanks everyone at Heritage Radio Network. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.